I've been here for over a week. So all last week we were having sessions on socialism, and my constraints were this. Number one, each session had to be somewhat self-contained, and because, you know, people come and go. Some people would just attend one session. And on the other hand, there were some people who would repeat, who would come back the next session. And so I couldn't repeat, because then it would be boring. So I had to have each session to be different, to be about socialism, to be different, kind of look at the argument from a different angle, but also to have a certain connection so that people who were here several times, that they could see how the argument unfolded. So that's the reason why we are kind of jumping onto something that appears to be out of the blue. But let me try to give you a sense of where this is coming from. In the next couple of slides, I'm gonna just go right ahead and present to you a case, what I call a case for socialism. I'm using here arguments that have been developed by traditional, conventional economic thinking. This is not an argument developed or based on radical thinkers, radical ideas, although they are connected. They are definitely, this argument connects with the argument that was put forth, say, by Karl Marx. But these notions actually are relatively recent, recent developments in economic thinking. I was telling the audience yesterday that these notions were the result of the research conducted by, among others, Paul Samuelson, who died recently. He was a professor at MIT, professor of economics, and he was the author of one of the most influential textbooks in economics ever, probably the most influential in the English-speaking world. Paul Samuelson received the first ever Nobel Prize in economics, the first Nobel Award that was granted to economists he received. And this is in a paper that he published, and I still haven't gotten there. It's something easy to Google when he published this paper. It's a paper, it's a relatively old paper from the 1960s or 1960s probably. It's called The Theory of, The Pure Theory of Public Choice, I think that's the title. And there are two concepts that are jargony, non-rivalry and non-excludability. Let me try and explain what these notions are about. The idea of non-rivalry is really simple. It's a property of goods, property, for example, of productive inputs. You know, when you are going to produce something, you need certain resources. You need to marshal certain resources. You need, you know, workers, you may need machines, you may need a space, land, you know, or physical space. You may need instruments, tools, raw materials, etc. Those are productive inputs. And so there is a certain quality of certain inputs that make them more shareable. In other words, you know, if, like, for example, just to use a simple good as an example, if I have an apple, right, and I eat it, you cannot eat it at once, right? If we have a basket with apples, then maybe all of us can eat apples, right? But that requires that we expand the amount of apples, right? If we have a car where only four people can, you know, be transported, then only four people can be transported there, right? So 10 people, that would be too congested, right? Etc. So goods that can be shared, or inputs that can be shared, right, are non-rivalrous. The inputs that can be shared are called non-rivalrous. Inputs or goods that cannot be shared, they are rivalrous. An apple would be rivalrous, because if I eat it, you cannot eat it at once. Now, Paul Samuelson, another economist after him, who studied this issue, realized that the more non-rivalrous goods become, the more difficult it is for them to be excluded. What do economists mean by this exclusion thing? Where exclusion means basically ownership. It means ownership, right? When you own something privately, that means that you are, by definition of ownership, you are excluding others from using or having access to this good without your permission, without your consent, right? In a system of private ownership, in a system of markets, right? In an economy, in a society where markets are the dominant form in which people cooperate, help each other, excludability means the ability of society to enforce the private ownership rights over the good, over those goods. So if I am not capable of preventing you from using the good without my consent, right, then our private ownership market economy is failing. It's failing because, you know, the premise of trade, the premise of a commercial exchange is that you own the good that you are holding now and that I own the good that I'm holding now. And then that we willingly, voluntarily, without anybody forcing us, right, that would be illegal, right, we decide to exchange the claim of ownership over these goods. Right? I have a good X, you have a good Y, I give you the rights of, you know, for the rights to enjoy the benefits of my good X, and then in exchange I receive the rights to use, dispose of good Y. Now I'm the owner of good Y, now you are the owner of good X. Within the confines of other laws, right, within the confines of the laws of physics, the laws of nature, you can pretty much do whatever you want with that good. Right? It's not like you can do whatever you want. It's like you can do whatever you want that is consistent with the laws of nature and also consistent with the laws of society. Right? So you can use directly the good, you can hand it away, you can give it away to somebody, you can throw it in the garbage, you can do certain things with it, right? As long as you don't violate the laws, etc. Okay, so, but what if the good that you have, the good that you that you legally own, right, is of such characteristics, it has such property, such qualities that you cannot prevent others from taking it away from you without your consent. Then the system fails. Right? The system fails. So if I have an apple, it's relatively easy for me to exclude you from using it. If I have many apples, if I have an apple orchard in Wenatchee, right, then I have to build a fence. Then I have to spend resources to try to protect my private property. And the bigger it is, the more resources I may have to, you know, I may have to spend in order to protect, to prevent others from accessing my property without my consent, from using my wealth without my consent. So it just becomes increasingly difficult for society to protect private ownership rights. So if that is the case, then that means that societies have to look for alternative ways to manage their resources, because if, for manage at least those goods, right? If those goods are difficult, if it is difficult for societies, costly for society has to spend too much resources to enforce the private ownership rights over those goods, then that means that society has to search for alternative ways to produce those goods, to provide these goods, and to overall, you know, manage them. And that's something that Paul Samuelson studied, etc., and other economists, not only him. So what I'm going to try to examine is what are the implications of this for our social order, and this provides a case for socialism. So here are the definitions, right? Non-rivalry is the shareability of inputs or goods. Non-excludability is the case when the cost of enforcing private ownership rights over a good or over an input of production is greater than that symbol there. For those of you who may be mathematically inclined, right, you know that that means greater than, right? Greater than the value of the input of the good. In other words, if, like in New York City, right, you have to buy a lock for your bike that is more expensive than the bike itself, then, like, you went too far, right? It's just not worth, you know, keeping people from stealing your bike, you know, because you're going to lose more money by having your lock destroyed. And so that's basically the thing. When society has to spend too much of its resources in locks, in cops, in, you know, police forces, has to spend too much on lawyers, a court system, jails and prisons, all that stuff, you know, in the to protect a property of a certain value, then it becomes increasingly harder and harder for society to sustain, to uphold those social structures. That means that different social structures, different economic arrangements have to be found to manage, you know, the production of goods in the economy. Now, in the previous sessions here, I proposed looking at wealth, the output of what we produce, right? The output of what we produce in an expansive manner, right? To include in it not only the items of ordinary wealth, like houses, roads, apples, oranges, computers, clothes, things like that, right? That's the usual, you know, the ordinary way in which we understand wealth. But also to think of wealth, and by the way, you know, I don't include so-called financial wealth here, because financial wealth is just the claims of ownership over that wealth, right? If you own a stock on a company, that means that you are entitled to the assets of that company, right? That's what it means to own shares of a company, the stock of a company. If you own bonds, you have a claim over the future income of whoever owes you money, right? So basically, the entire superstructure of financial assets that are traded in financial markets is just the titles of ownership. It's one way or another, is the deeds of ownership over all the wealth in society, or over at least a portion of it, that are traded there in those markets. So this, you know, ultimately, you know, it's a claim over the actual wealth that has to be produced by society, and the wealth that is produced by society is produced the hard way. That is, you have to take a piece of nature, and you, with labor, you have to transform it. You may have to use machines, but then you have to produce the machines, which requires, again, a chunk of nature, and then labor, layers and layers of labor, and then the actual living labor, and perhaps additional chunks of nature to produce wealth, right? But back to this idea that we are understanding wealth not only in the ordinary sense, but we are also including, as part of the wealth that we produce, the social structures that we produce, the social structure that we create. Like, for example, you know, this is the example that a couple of days ago I came up with. Suppose that the road is, like, you know, covered with rocks, and we need to clear it, right? So we need to clear the road. So we need to push the rocks to the side so that trucks can circulate, bus can pass by. So we will be producing, if we, you know, a bunch of us goes and tries to push the rocks off to the side, we are producing a clear, accessible road, right? We are producing wealth in a physical way. It's going to be a clear road, which is physically different from a road that is, you know, blocked with rocks. But in addition to that, right, because we are cooperating in and you know, kind of coordinating our actions in order to get the road clear, we are also creating a social structure. We are creating some sort of social, there is a social, social structure that we are creating there. And not only that, we are also creating ourselves, because the person that is going to emerge out of that process is going to be a different person. It's going to be a person at least, you know, tired after pushing rocks to the side, right? But it's not only that, but we also gain experience, etc. You know, we have, by clearing the road, we become people productive of clear roads. Okay, so when we include, you know, in our notion of wealth, not only the ordinary items of wealth, but also our social relations and also ourselves as the ultimate product of what, you know, what we produce ultimately is ourselves, right? We may go like in a roundabout way, but ultimately what we are trying to produce is ourselves. And what exactly is it that we want? You know, we can call it in different, using different terms, right? Like happiness, welfare, perhaps what we want is individual freedom, right? Basically, we are producing ourselves, you know, we are producing our humanity, and the output is that, and the input is, you know, a chunk of nature, and then humanity, because you have to spend time as a worker to produce whatever you want to produce, etc. And, you know, if it is machines, then, you know, it's just, those machines have to be produced. If it is buildings, those buildings have to be produced, etc. All of that entails a certain sacrifice of our humanity to produce humanity, right? To produce more freedom, to produce more power, etc.
That output you mentioned yesterday, you included as a kind of joke, humanity plus. You mentioned garbage.
Garbage, right?
It's, yeah, it's waste. There's always a waste product.
You're absolutely right. Right? Except, yeah. Sometimes this is kind of my shorthand way of doing it, because I say, you know, you produce humanity minus a little bit of humanity that is that you have to subtract, and that comes from the fact that, you know, the garbage that we generate bites us back, so it takes away some of our happiness. So this is net happiness. You know, it's total happiness minus the garbage.
Right.
The unhappiness produced by the garbage, so net happiness. That is just an abbreviated. But yeah, you're good. You are right that we should emphasize that thing. So here's the case for socialism. Summarize. In some of these points, I have made them in previous sessions, but I'll be glad to expand a little bit on them if they look mysterious to you. Expanding our productive power, in other words, increasing our productivity in just plain lay terms, right? Increasing our productivity. How do we measure productivity? Output per unit of input, right? What is our output? Well, happiness, right? Welfare, well-being, humanity. And what is our input? Humanity plus nature, right? So, you know, it's per unit of land, how many apples we produce, right? Per unit of labor, right? Per unit, per hour of sweat, how many apples we produce, because apples give us happiness when we eat them, right? So expanding our productive power, that means expanding output per unit of input, requires that we expand the scale of labor cooperation. I showed this in a previous session, but we can use it with a very simple illustration, that illustration of pushing a rock off the road, you know, to take the rock out of the way. And in order for us, if that rock is heavy enough, one single individual won't be able to move it, right? So you can have five individuals taking turns. Each of them comes and tries to push the rock. Nothing happens to the rock. Second individual, nothing happens to the rock. Three individuals, nothing happens. However, if the individuals cooperate, then they can push the, even without tools, right? They can push the rock out of the way. And so basically expanding our productivity from removing zero rocks out of the way to removing one rock out of the way, we need cooperation. We need to cooperate. Now when we think about, you know, what it is entailed by cooperation, right? Cooperation requires that we share at least one input of production. Like in this case, right, the purpose of removing the rock out of the way is a shared input. It has to be shared. If people, you know, don't agree on what to do, then somebody may want to move the rock, somebody may want to hold it there. And so there has to be some sort of agreement, so that means that people have to share at least language so that they understand each other, right? And then they have to share the purpose. We're going to move the rock out of the way, right? And they're going to share the space. They're going to have to share the road because they're going to be operating on the road. They're going to be operating on the rock. The rock is also going to be shared by the people who are going to be pushing it out of the way. So expanding our productive power requires expanding the scale of labor cooperation. Expanding the scale of labor cooperation requires that some inputs be shared. And remember that the shareability of inputs, or in general the shareability of goods, is what economists call non-rivalry. So that means that we need more inputs that are shareable, that are non-rivalrous. And since non-rivalry makes excludability more costly, in other words, since you know, the more non-rivalrous the inputs are, the more difficult it is to enforce private ownership right over them, then private ownership, market-based, you know, economics becomes increasingly expensive for society. And therefore, society has to develop alternative social structures to better handle production. So that is my case for socialism summarized. Now, I'll give you plenty of time for you to talk. Somebody here, I think, was it you that asked about, you know, diminishing returns or something, right? So I want to connect a little bit the story with that issue of diminishing returns. See how is that connected. So I'm using here a very simple illustration. It's a restaurant that is producing, it has only one oven, you know, one building with an oven, right? One establishment, physical facility with an oven, and it produces pizzas and pizzas only. And now, I want you to think of, you know, sometimes, like, we need this kind of illustration to see a point, but I want you to keep in mind that what I really am trying to say here, this is, think of this as a metaphor. It's a metaphor, it's an analogy, but instead of pizzas, right, imagine that what we are producing is, you know, ourselves. Ultimately, we are producing ourselves, right? That's what we are doing. And we are using ourselves to produce ourselves, right? Ourselves plus nature. Okay? So that's really what this, the way, you know, that we should look at this. Okay, so very simple. The numbers, I just pulled them off my hair, so they may not make much sense. But, you know, the idea is that that you have one single oven, right? But you can have a different number of workers. You can have more workers. And by the way, each worker is bringing, like, you know, when in Brooklyn, when somebody needs a contractor, right, goes to Home Depot and then hires, you know, people who are there offering their services. And usually those people are bringing their tools. They have their hammers and everything there. Right, so like imagine that here the workers all come equipped with their dog, right, to make the pizzas, right? So the amount of workers and the amount of dog, because each worker is bringing dog, right, with himself or herself, is variable. You can have more workers plus dog or less, right? And then the amount of pizzas, because there is only one oven and the oven has a certain physical size that is finite, is limited. Then as you increase the number of workers, they may get on each other's ways, right? That means that, you know, the oven may become crowded out, right? So they can share the oven up to a point, but then the oven is going to be congested, right? That's what I mean here. So as a result, the amount of pizza that the amount of pizzas that the next worker is producing kind of tends to decline. That is the diminishing returns story, right? So if you go from one worker to two workers, then the first worker produces 10 pizzas, but the second worker will be producing only 8. It's adding 8 to 10. So that will be altogether 18. And so on and so forth. As you can see, right, the next worker, the third worker, is only producing 6 pizzas, the next worker only 4, etc. There is a point at which the next worker so crowded out, right, the use of the oven, that now the next worker is not even capable of producing any pizza, right? I'm exaggerating this so that you see the point here. So because the worker plus dog, right, it's costing you $10, and this is a generous assumption I'm making, right? If we are talking about, you know, the economy in general, and there is already, everybody's already fully employed, and you want more labor, right? You may have to pay more for the next worker, and here the next worker is always costing you $10, $10, $10, $10, right? So if you use five workers, then you pay $50, $10 to each worker, right? But I'm saying that if you have like everybody employed and everybody's already working the number of shifts that they want to work, the number of hours that they want to work, and you want to elicit, you know, a greater supply of labor, then you're going to have to, society is going to have to employ more resources to attract additional labor, right? So that means that it may be more costly. But I'm going to make the assumption that the cost is flat. The cost of each worker is always $10, $10, $10, $10. And here I'm using money, right? But actually what I'm referring is the cost for society. Remember, what society uses is humanity plus nature. So that's what the expenditure is, ultimately. Okay, now, the cost of the oven is fixed. It's always, that's why I call it fixed cost. This is variable cost. I'm using the jargon in economics. So $100, regardless of the number of pizzas produced, because, you know, it's one oven and that's what the oven costs you. You can think of it as the rent of the oven or something like that, right? If you don't own it, but you rent it, that's what you have to pay. And you have to pay that rent regardless of how many pizzas you produce and how many workers you hire. Okay, so the total cost would be the cost of the variable inputs and the cost of the fixed input. So that's the total cost. It's the sum of those two columns, gives you this column here. Right, so now, let's think now about the cost per pizza. The cost per pizza. So you have to take the cost and divide them by the number of pizzas produced. Like, for example, if you want to know the variable cost per pizza, that will be here, right? Variable cost per pizza. Where is the variable cost? $10. And the number of pizzas, 10 pizzas. Each pizza is costing you $1 in labor plus dog costs. Right? That's the variable cost per pizza. And so on and so forth. Now, this is the fixed cost per unit, or fixed average cost, as economists call it, right? FAC. Fixed average cost. So you take the cost of the fixed input, which is the oven, divided by the number of pizzas, and you get this column here. Right? You get this column here. Now, look at the effect. Remember that here, the oven is the shareable input. And the oven is the non-rivalrous up to a point, right? Non-rivalrous input. Because workers can use the oven, right, up to a point. When they crowd out the use of the oven, then it's not shareable anymore because it gets congested, it gets too crowded out. Okay, so look at the effect, right? The variable average cost is gonna go up, right? And this is under the very generous assumption that the next worker is gonna cost you the same as the previous one, right? Again, if there were full employment, then this would be a larger number, because in order for society to elicit more labor supply, it will have to give more resources to people to persuade them to work longer hours, another shift, etc., right? So then this would climb up faster. This would go up even faster. Now, how about the fixed average cost? That's the cost of the shareable input, the oven, per unit of output. That means per pizza. Right, the cost per pizza that comes from the use of the oven, and you see that declines. That's what economists call the spread out effect. Right, you have an oven, you have to pay for it, you have to pay the rent of the oven, or you have the price of the oven, right? Then you better produce as many pizzas as you can, right? Because that way you can spread the cost of the oven among more pizzas. You will be producing more pizzas. So you see that this can only go down, except that it goes down very fast at first, and then it goes down, but you really have to push output to higher and higher levels if you want these numbers to go further down. I may have some figures here that are not correct, because I did those calculations quickly, and I should have done this with Excel, but I was working on PowerPoint. Okay, now the total average cost is the sum of the of this these two, or if you prefer, the total cost divided by the number of pizzas. Take this divided by this, that gives you this. And so you can see that this guy here, the variable average cost is going up. This one is going down, right? In industries, in you know branches of production where you have more shareable inputs, right? This factor is going to be the main one, and this is going to be secondary, right? Like for example, in the production of trucks, you need to make a very large upfront investment. You need to build, you know, big factory with robots, etc., in order to be able to produce the first truck, right? Or a Hollywood movie, right? In order to produce a blockbuster movie, you need to spend a lot of money upfront, right? A lot of money upfront. So in those industries where the investment, the initial investment has to be very large, because you have to put in place shareable inputs, inputs that are non-rivalrous, right? This is going to prevail, right? In other words, the decline in the decreasing average cost is going to be more important than this one, the increasing variable cost per unit. And as a result, the net effect is going to be like costs are going to go down, are going to go down. When that is the case, the producers feel like taking over the world. You know, they feel like they want to become bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, right? Think of energy production, like electricity production, right? Or the delivery to households of electricity or internet, fast internet connections. You want to have as many subscribers as possible because you already have the network. All you have to do is just hook up each additional subscriber. Each additional subscriber is going to cost you less and less and less, right? And because you're going to spread out the cost of the network, the cost of the network among more subscribers, right? If you are a musician, you are producing music, right? It's the cost of producing the first CD. That is the one that you know that is more taxing to you. But once you have the song, the piece, then you can just replicate it more easily, right? Or you can stream it on the internet or something, right? So, so that was just kind of to connect it with your remark from yesterday. So here is just in a graphical form here, you know, as you produce more pizzas, what happened to the cost per pizza? This is the cost dollars per pizza. And you see that at first, the total cost, which is the green curve, is very high. And then it comes down. So that you want to expand the production of pizzas because you have a very costly shareable input, fixed input, that is the oven, right? But unfortunately, you know, this is the bad news, right? The cost of your variable inputs is going to go up, and it's at a point, because this is the sum of this plus this. This at a point, this is going to overwhelm this, and then that's the point where your cost per pizza is going to start to go up, right? So going beyond that point is going to hurt you increasingly. So again, you know, think of this not as, you know, a business, an individual, you know, privately owned business, but think of it from the perspective of society as a whole, right? Trying to produce, instead of pizzas, happiness, right? Produce our humanity, you know, as free individuals, etc. Right? So what is the lesson there is that what I'm suggesting here is this. Now, suppose that this is production of inputs that have more idea content than ovens, because the example I'm using here is a shareable or non-rivalrous input that is an oven. But then think of, for example, music or movies or software code. And then suppose that also, right, this is another assumption that we need, that the ideas to store, transmit, receive, and use ideas, in other words, the technology to produce technology, the technology to produce music and transmit it, share it, etc., and use it, access it, all of that becomes cheaper, you know, photocopy machines, faxes, scanners, computers, internet, etc. All that technology becomes less and less expensive. Then, you know, the conclusion is private ownership becomes too expensive for society to enforce. And if the ideas embodied in our wealth, right? Remember, wealth understood not only in the ordinary sense, but also the wealth of our social structures, the wealth embodied in ourselves, right? Ultimately, that's the real wealth, ourselves as free individuals. Then, to the extent that the idea content of wealth expands, then private ownership becomes more expensive for society, right? And if ideas for copying and sharing ideas become more economical to produce, then the private ownership enforcement becomes more costly for society. Then how can society encourage the production of ideas and then the production of ideas about replicating, transmitting, receiving, and using ideas if the producers cannot exclude others from using that wealth without their consent, without being able to pocket the benefits of that wealth that they produce? Then societies have to come up with different arrangements. And I think that socialism is precisely that type of an arrangement, where, you know, where people are gonna have, for example, this is a complaint. Like in my neighborhood, there are a lot of artists who, you know, very creative people, of all kinds, musicians and all that. So their complaint is, you know, if I produce a piece of music that, you know, that is good, people are going to use it for free because they're going to access it in the internet. If I put it on the internet, or even if I put it in a CD, because people copy the files from the CD to the internet and then they share them on the internet. So what is my incentive to produce that, right? Aside from the satisfaction that I get from producing it, you know, society is obviously not compensating me for the happiness that I give them. And so why should I give them happiness, right? And in a system of markets, in a system of private ownership, people, you know, produce looking after their own private individual interest. So the answer is, well, society is going to have to be creative and come up with different arrangements to fund, right, that kind of creativity, that kind of disposition to produce beauty and to produce, wealth. And how has that been done in history? Well, even in the United States, we can find many examples of how that can be done. Like, for example, FDR, right? One of the policies that FDR implemented to deal with this high unemployment rates, the New Deal type of thing, was to promote art and, you know, to fund artists, right? Jason Pollock, right, the painter, for example, received some sort of endowment, you know, by an agency of the federal government that was in charge of promoting art. And so you have to find other ways in which you have to compensate artists for the production of wealth that benefits society as a whole. And so that is, it is a narrow case for socialism, but this is an argument that I think I could make just on the basis, again, on the basis not of the ideas of very radical thinkers, but on the ideas that economists, who are not, you know, precisely famous for being radical on these matters, that ideas that they themselves have come up with. And I just think that they haven't pushed the argument all the way to the end. But it seems clear to me that a different way of managing resources has to be devised when the idea content of the wealth that we produce expands. Yesterday, just to wrap up this idea, yesterday we were talking about how, and I was referring to Wenatchee because I learned that while I was in Wenatchee, that an apple, as plain as an apple may seem to us, right, increasingly, compare, say, with 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago, even though the apple may look the same as 20 years or 30 years ago, the idea content of that apple is very different. There is a lot of science right, in embedded or embodied in that apple, because a lot of research is done to produce apples nowadays. Yeah, it's not, you know, it's not just like common sense seed selection, the kind of thing that people 30 years, 40 years ago did. But now, you know, like I learned that in Wenatchee, they put this reflective material under the trees so that the, you know, the apples, that it kills two birds with the same stone, because you keep the grass from growing underneath, so you don't let the grass steal the nutrients from the apple tree, and also you give sunlight to the apples from different directions, so it makes the apples richer and more flavorful. So that just goes to show how even the simplest or the plainest of items, you know, pieces of wealth that we can imagine, incorporate increasing amounts of information, ideas, design. And to the extent that this is a good that is shareable in an absolute way, right? Ideas are absolutely shareable. That was kind of the topic of yesterday's, or that's something that we emphasized in yesterday's presentation and yesterday's session. To the extent that ideas grow, their role in our social life expands, then there is an increasing need, just plain economic need. It just flows from the economics of this, that we need to look for other social arrangements, because markets and private ownership become incapable of handling that wealth, which ultimately, again, is our humanity that we're talking about here. You know, it becomes more wasteful of our humanity. And that manifests itself in the form of more social conflicts over ownership, for example. You know, and also crisis and all those adverse phenomena that bother us so much that, you know, So that is the argument I wanted to present today, and I would invite comments, and they don't have to be necessarily related to this, but it would be great if they are. But feel free to add, subtract.
What are some of the new social arrangements that people are proposing or writing about or researching?
Different societies are going to have to, you know, experiment with different things, because the solutions have to be consistent with the history and with the characteristics of the people in each particular setting. And I don't have like absolute answers. I mean, there are many possible arrangements. I think Holden Village is a shining, you know, illustration of how these things can be managed in a very robust manner. You know, you have that dining hall open, right? I think it's 24 hours open, is it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
24 hours is open. It's always food there. It's always milk there. It's always cereal there. And and people can just go, and you are hungry, you just go and eat. Right? How do we, Holden Village, fund that? You know, I guess Chuck should tell us how we managed to do that, right, without breaking eroding the sustainability of this economy, of Holden Village's economy. So there are many, the idea of building socialism is that of creating social structures that push us, that force us to cooperate, that kind of lock in the need for cooperation. It's a little bit like an argument, or not an argument, a discussion we were having yesterday about the environment. I don't know if any of you were here last night, right? Here in the, no, you weren't here at the forum. There was a forum here on what was the title? Something like caring about the creation, you know, caring about the environment, like trying to preserve, areas of the natural environment as pristine as possible. And you know, there are a lot of initiatives that require, you know, individual changes in behavior. You know, we as consumers may have to adjust our behavior and whatnot. But we also were talking about how difficult some of these individual choices are for us. You know, like turning off the light, using more the bike, and how difficult it is. And some people, who are less wealthy and less powerful may have more pressing constraints that make it more difficult for them to make the right choices as consumers. You know, it just becomes easier to do the wrong thing for society as a whole. So, we were talking about the need to change policies, which requires political activity, right? In order to, you know, pass legislation that fosters the right choices, right, that creates a framework where people are more forced to make the right choices. And in this discussion that we had yesterday back and forth, I alluded to the case of, anecdote by Billy Gates in a book that he wrote in the early 2000s, The Road Ahead. You may not remember it, but you know, I something that I remember very clearly was that he said that he was so addicted to playing Minesweeper or Solitaire, one of those games, that he decided to remove them from his hard disk. That way, he make it more difficult for himself to indulge in his addiction to playing those games. So I thought, if a person that has, you know, that is obviously a high-performance person like Billy Gates, right, has to, you know, impose those constraints on himself, because we are really like, you know, like several forces in us pulling us in different directions, right? And sometimes the smart force in us has to say like, hey, wait a minute, this is the ethical thing to do, or this is the right thing to do, so I'm going to try to keep the other parts of me from pulling me away from this. So, you know, similarly in the case of society, because we are made up by, you know, individuals with different markets, kind of tend to disintegrate us and to make us look at things from our own individual perspective and look at others not as individuals with their own needs and with their own, you know, personality and uniqueness, but we look at others just as instruments for our own benefit. And we just want to look at others that way, as instruments to our own ends. And so what we want is precisely a different type of social mechanism, right? That because that independence and self-reliance that markets foster is an illusion, right? It's an illusion. It should be clear to us that when we go to a supermarket and buy a gallon of milk, that means that we are dependent upon people who wake up at 4 in the morning to milk those cows, to put those, you know, crates with milk jugs in the truck to ship it to the supermarket. So it's a lot of people that are involved in, you know, in those in these things, but we don't see that's invisible to us, right? And then so we just see, you know, our interaction with others in terms of what's in it for me. But that shows its limits, and this is a case where that kind of arrangement shows its limits. And so that means that we have to use other mechanisms, like, for example, civic mechanisms, direct communication among people, political mechanisms, perhaps, right? Where people make choices collectively, and make choices collectively that help us as individuals make the right choices, right? Because if we just rely on, you know, on their very difficult circumstances and settings that push us in, you know, in the wrong direction, if we just rely on people to individually decide to turn off the switch, to, you know, to use the bike more than the truck, then it's going to be much harder. So it seems that one way or another, we have to look for those mechanisms. And those mechanisms of the more direct involvement, you know, I call them civic, you know, political, you know, we can discuss, you know, what the right term for that is. But it has to be bypassing the market, because the market is showing its failures.
I think that what it seems to me when I look at it It seems to me that what you're talking about is a system where you've got, you create this non, where you've got lots of resources. And really, the system that we've got is designed to share scarce resources. And how do you divide those scarce resources amongst the people? And I don't know if what system is out there that would do what really capitalism has done in that fashion. I think that when we look at society, I mean, I'm not from the United States either. I'm from Canada. So I would say that we've got a mixed system in Canada where we still have a pretty capitalist society, but we decide, you know, what are the important things that there shouldn't be rivalry on. Like we say, well, medical care, there shouldn't be rivalry. Everybody should have a right to that. And they should have a right to a basic standard of living. But I don't know how you divide up everything else without having some system which says, if I put more into this, like the farmer that's there, built milk, that owns all those cows and does all that stuff, and he works 12 or 14 hours a day, why should he not receive a fair share of what's going out to society? And I think that's the system that we've come to rely on, is, you know, because resources are scarce. You look at the power, you look at the oil that you've got, everything's got scarce resources, and you don't have unlimited input. And that's where I don't think that we've dealt with that.
Well, let me see if I can flip a little bit that, right? What does it mean to say that resources or goods are scarce? I think it simply means that our productive powers are limited, they are finite, right? As I said yesterday, you know, the trips to the moon are scarce because producing trips to the moon is very expensive. You know, we have to spend a lot of us in order to produce a trip to the moon. And producing raw oil, crude oil, it's very expensive. So as a result, crude oil is limited, is finite, is scarce. You know, it took the natural evolution of the earth to produce that millions and millions of years. We cannot produce crude oil, you know, in a way that is economical, you know, with the technology that we have, the resources that we have nowadays. So it is true, but on the other hand, we have seen, and prompted by the development of capitalism in the last few centuries, that the productive powers of society have expanded. Where the gains have gone is a different story, right? We, like, for example, in the US in the last 30 years, productivity measured by the Bureau of Economic Analysis or by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, whoever does this calculation, has increased. Right here in the library, there is a Harper magazine that I was just browsing the other day, and the Harper Index says that, you know, I forgot the period, but it's like from the 1970-something to 2010, 2009, labor productivity expanded by 100% plus. And then the real wage of workers expanded by negative something percent. We'll say that it was flat, 0%, right? No, don't make it negative, 0%. But then this doubled, productivity doubled, the pie became bigger and bigger and bigger, the share that went to working people was stagnant, so that means that most of the gains were to people whose claim over that wealth is because they own wealth, but because they own power. They hold power, they hold wealth, and then because you need wealth to produce wealth, then you can appropriate those gains from the expansion in the productive powers of people. So what I guess the argument I'm making here is that, you know, to the extent that we can make a dent on scarcity, and by the way, by this I don't mean, and I have to emphasize that, right, because I think the environmentalists have made a very good argument, that very persuasively, and that we have to remember that the production of wealth, human wealth, in this expansive interpretation that I prefer, That doesn't mean the expansion of stuff. That doesn't mean producing more stuff. That doesn't mean producing more garbage. That actually, producing more garbage means subtracting from the wealth that we produce. So we have to really account for wealth properly. Then we have definitely become more productive of wealth in this definition I'm talking about. Except that so far it hasn't been well allocated. But to the extent that we have become more productive, to that extent the need to overcome markets increases. I'm not saying that all of a sudden we are ready for, you know, full, perfect, ideal socialism, right? Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is that, you know, looking at the setting, looking at the particular conditions in each place, you know, and also kind of looking at different, not only looking at each particular location and the conditions there, but also looking at the needs at a global scale. You know, we may need some combination of economic arrangements, but we have to move in a direction that is consistent with what we observe to be kind of the trend in human life.
You see, I would say yes, my philosophy would be that if you've determined what society needs, and you've got a system in place that, yeah, it's got lots of flaws, but it generally divides up the goods in some fashion. And so, but you're saying, well, too much is going back to the owners of the stockholders, right? Or the,
for example,
whoever it is. So you increase your level of taxation that says, no, a bigger portion of this pie is for the whole of society, not for the stockholders. And then you've got a redistribution system that happens.
Yes.
In some fashion.
Yes.
And that is not taking a whole system and throwing it away. It just is redefining this.
Right.
What's happening?
Reforming it, or, you know, yeah, like kind of tweaking it a little bit here and there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would respond that, in fact, I don't think, at least in what would say last 500 years or so, that we have faced an economy of scarcity. I don't think we have. We're talking about a great boon from the time of the discovery of the New World until the present day of increasing not only productive capacity, but natural resource use and availability. So that what you have over that time, and I would say 500 years, but let's even now confine it to the last 50 or 60 years, is an ever-expanding pie. That we all share in some capacity. So we're arguing over the spoils of an expanding pie. Scarcity would be when that pie begins to shrink, and then we all sort of then are faced with the prospect of how then do you divide up those pieces of the pie among an ever-expanding population, etc. So in fact, I would argue the basic premise that we deal with scarce resources, at least so far. I mean, I think changing circumstances are definitely changing, and that's what I don't think people quite fully grasp yet. And B, what I hear, the whole argument of the point of diminishing returns is that the pie has to stop expanding at some point because A, we don't have the same natural resources to use, and B, you reach scarcity where that pie begins to shrink, even though the people who want a piece of that pie continues to expand. That's the point of scarcity. But the argument, at least as has been presented today, as I understand it, is you reach a point of diminishing returns in whether it's ideas or wealth creation or our ability to create wealth or something like that, reaches that point of diminishing returns, and thus, that's where capitalism begins to fail. It's an economic failure of market capitalism, thus necessitating new social structures to deal with scarcity.
I think that it is the need for new social structures to deal with the expanded productive power, which is the reciprocal of scarcity, right? Scarcity would be less output per unit of input, and higher productivity means more output per unit of input. I agree with most of what you said. Yeah, please.
Okay. And as an example, capitalism is not equipped to deal with an idea like peak oil.
Right. This is what I was going to say. Right. The strictures or the apparent scarcity that we sometimes face is not the result of a shrinking productive powers. Is the result of the failure of the current social structures that we have in place to manage our resources that are not doing the job correctly. And that appears to us as greater scarcity. I mean, like, for example, like, let's just think of the situation today, you know, as a result of the financial crisis and all that, right? This financial crisis, as a result, banks, you know, reduce their lending. As a result, you know, businesses become more, you know, risk averse, uncertain about what may happen in the future. So they start laying off people, they shrink their operations. And then as a result, people have less money to spend in the economy. As a result, the economy shrinks altogether. And it's a vicious cycle, right? You have now unemployment close to 10%, right? 9-point-something%. That actually is an increase over the previous, you know, figure that was available. So, and we have how many years since 2007? We already have like 4 years of stagnation, virtual stagnation. You know, the NBR, the National Bureau of Economic Research, decides today they the business cycle. So they decided that there was already a recovery, but it was a recovery without jobs. So the unemployment rate wasn't really coming down. That means that you have here bunch of workers, bunch of factories idle. You are not, or you know, you have here roads with a lot of rocks and people here that are not doing anything about it. You have kids, you have teachers, right? And oops, you know, the state doesn't have resources to put them together, right? So that is a scarcity to many people. You are unemployed, you know. It's a scarcity, you know, very real type of scarcity, but it's an artificial type of scarcity that is created by the inability of the social structure that we have to manage our productive powers. Right? Because why should we be constrained by trade? You know, like this is the example that I always use. You know, when I trade with you, right, I'm giving you X, you're giving me Y, and we are happy about it, right? We are okay with it. To the extent that the rate at which I exchange X for Y is what results from the haggling of buyers and sellers of X and Y, right? There is a market for X and Y. Say that Y is money, right? You sell milk. You know, I will pay you, you know, $2 per gallon of milk. Why $2? Why not $3? Why not $5? Oh, because that is the price that emerges out of the interaction between buyers and sellers of milk in the local market. Right? So you feel happy about it because that's what the market says. I feel happy about it because that's what the market says. Right? But now, how about changing? But it's limited. Why is it limited? Because I will not have the milk. You will not give it to me if I don't pay you the $2 per gallon. If I only have $1, I'm sorry, but you know it's $2 per gallon. Right? If you are just looking at me as an instrument to your own ends, you have no reason to give me the milk. Right, for one, or if I have $0 because I'm unemployed, forget it, I don't have the milk. You have the milk, I need it, I don't get the milk. Right? So why should we limit our you know, helping each other? Because that's basically what we are doing through the markets. I'm scratching your back, you are scratching my back. I'm giving you money, you are giving me milk. Right? But why should we put those constraints in the helping each other? Why not? You give me the milk, well, you can say credit. Okay, that expands a little bit the limits, but it still is limited, right? Say that you grant me credit. Okay, here's the milk. You know, you don't have the money now, but then when you have the money tomorrow, you repay me with interest. Okay, suppose that tomorrow I don't have the money with interest to pay you. Then you may say, forget it, you know, you cannot honor your IOU. I'm not going to give you milk anymore. Right? So we are breaking, we are withdrawing from social cooperation. Right? Social cooperation means that I help you, you help me. But now, because of an accident that happened to me or whatever, I cannot, you know, I don't have the money tomorrow, so I don't honor the IOU. And then you pull back, I pull back, we break our social structure. Right? We withdraw, and then, you know, our market disappears. Right? The market evaporates. So we are breaking up society. And then instead, how about this? Do you produce milk? Because you just enjoy producing milk, and because you like to help people who need to drink milk, because you take pride and satisfaction from producing milk, good quality milk, etc. And I, you know, do something else for society. Why not building a society on that basis? You may say, well, it's utopian, you know, because, you know, well, it's utopian, but it may not be utopian. Maybe we can partially approximate it. Maybe we can move in that direction little by little. Like, you know, Canadians, okay, well, public healthcare. Why? Because healthcare privatized is not healthcare. It's something else, right? It's just not doing the job for us. So we get rid of market, we replace that structure with something else. Public national health care system, right, etc. Right, little by little, right, by moving in that direction. Yes.
Is it socialism if you make him work for the milk?
Yeah.
In order for him to pay off that debt, as it were, he comes and milks the cows one morning.
Well, you see, socialism doesn't want to create a dependency where people. You know, where people are just passive recipients of charity. Because, you know, that is not consistent with human nature. I don't think that many people, you know, enjoy that kind of situation where you depend on the charity of others. That is kind of a level of, you know, a level of a social pathology. It's not the, you know, for the most part, you know, people have to liberate themselves. People have to contribute to society. People shouldn't be parasites. But when we say parasites, you ask Tea Party people, you know, what is a social parasite? And they're going to think of a welfare queen. Somebody, a woman of a certain, you know, black African-American woman with many children driving a Cadillac and going to the welfare, you know, office to collect, you know, benefits. Whereas if you ask me, you know, what is a social parasite, I'm going to think of, you know, Goldman Sachs type of people, right? Which I think that are like vampires, that are, you know, sucking the blood dry of our social body. You know, in what is their claim to that, to disposing of so much wealth? Oh, that they own wealth, that they were born in wealth, or that they, you know, hold wealth. You know, but wealth is social product, you know, and even the private ownership doesn't exist without society devoting resources and upholding private ownership rights. It's a social arrangement. Private ownership is a social arrangement. We legislate private ownership rights. So it's up to us to unlegislate private ownership. Yes.
I would even go so far as to say our understanding of capitalism is very much a social product of the fossil fuel era. I mean, we spend a lot of time talking about humanity, but it's nature plus humanity, and there's something to be said about nature as well. So when I think we talk about scarcity, we're missing an adjective, whereas relative scarcity is what capitalism is equipped to deal with. Absolute scarcity is another question entirely. And I think that's the sort of paradigm shift that we're approaching in many, many ways. And thus, it's those that that's in many ways, without actually going through that explanation of the process, but you've done a very good job of doing it, that's where market failures happen that create the space for new social arrangements. But I think in our discussion of scarcity, we miss that adjective. It's relative scarcity is different than absolute scarcity in many ways. Many fundamentally important ways.
You mean, like, for example, the scarcity of natural resources would be absolute because there is a certain amount of, say, crude oil.
Right, and it's not that we will run out of crude oil, it's that you reach that point of diminishing returns or ever-increasing costs, you've reached the peak, and when your entire global economy is based on those fossil fuel resources, then everything becomes more expensive. So to continue the example with the farmer, today that gallon of milk costs $2. Whether he can pay for it or not is irrelevant at this point. But today that gallon of milk costs $2. The inputs for the farmer include raising the grain to feed to the cows that can then produce the milk. Raising the grain requires a great deal of fossil fuel resources. Peak oil, or oil, petroleum, natural gas, you know, nitrogen fertilizer, and everything that goes along with that. So in an era of absolute scarcity, all of those original inputs become that much more expensive and cannot, in fact, become cheaper because of absolute scarcity. So as time goes on, those inputs to the farmer become that much more expensive over time, which means that tomorrow that gallon of milk, the ultimate output, is not $2, it's $2.50, and the next day it's $3, and the day after that it's $4. That's the nature of absolute scarcity as opposed to relative scarcity. Whereas relative scarcity, the inputs become too expensive to create the grain to feed to the cows, you go someplace else or you substitute it, you know, or you do something, you know, something else in order to provide that input to the cows in order to maintain the price at, you know, roughly $2 a gallon.
I may look at things a little bit differently, but I may not have time to.
No, I keep presenting these problems to you at the end of our discussion.
Right.
So you have done a very good job of addressing them in the next day's session. I appreciate that.
Okay, so I'll try and chew on that. Anybody else who has a comment? You know, like there was another, just to use this minute, you know, you think of something, just stop me and ask or say something. There was a gentleman here. Oh, maybe was it you who mentioned something about scale?
That was me.
That was you. But yeah, you say that socialism seems to work better at a smaller scale.
Oh no, I was asking. I definitely phrased asking. That as a question.
Okay, yeah. You posed that as a question. Okay, well, you know, I was thinking, you know, for example, should a society try to expand or, you know, reappropriate, you know, a bigger chunk of social wealth, or, you know, should it allow for, you know, that wealth to remain private and just limit to a, you know, narrow slice of the social wealth? And because of the scale issue, right? The more you try to chew, the more difficult it becomes, right? Because of the scale. And one of the arguments would be, kind of human nature frame. Because when we don't see the people, when we don't know the people, when we don't interact with people on a regular basis, then we don't care about those people as much. So how is it possible for us to have a socialism at a national scale in the United States when you have the East Coast, the West Coast,
Hey, don't forget the South.
The South and the Midwest and everything. And so how is it possible to cooperate, you know, when you don't know those people and they don't know you and you are so different? And so I was thinking, well, you know, one of the things that immediately popped in my head was this idea of, you know, because that's an argument that critics like very adversarial critics of socialism have brandished. They said, like Hayek, Friedrich von Hayek, an Austrian economist who also won the Nobel Prize, and who said, it is impossible for a socialist economy to function because it needs to, to solve a lot of mathematical problems, and it would entail a tremendous amount of computation for that, etc. And then I thought, tell that, like society, you cannot own so much wealth because it's such a large scale and it's going to require so much computation and so much calculations and all that. Tell that to J.P. Morgan when he was taking over the railroad system in the United States. Walmart nowadays is the size of many African economies together. And however, they manage those things in a centralized manner. Right? They plan those operations at a centralized manner. And the guys wouldn't be shy by this argument. If you tell them it's not possible to manage so much of an economy, leave that problem to me, I will solve it. That's how they would address it. So I have to stop, though.
Yeah, von Hayek's book was called Road to Serfdom, which some people would actually call a fairly accurate description of Walmart.
Okay, thank you very much for attending. Come back tomorrow if you think you're good.